This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is novelist Pat Conroy. He's best known as the author of The Great Santini, which was made into a film of the same name. It starred Robert Duvall as a Marine fighter pilot who runs his family as if they were under his command in the military. The character was based on Conroy's own domineering father, who was also a Marine. Two more of Conroy's autobiographical novels have been made into films. The Lords of Discipline drew on his experiences in military college. The Water is Wide, the basis of the film Conrack, is taken from Conroy's experiences teaching in a two-room schoolhouse on an island off the South Carolina coast, which was totally cut off from the modern world. His latest novel, the bestseller The Prince of Tides, is told from the perspective of a high school coach who's on the verge of divorce. His twin sister, a feminist poet, has attempted suicide. To help her piece her life together, he must examine how his father's abusive behavior has emotionally crippled the entire family. Conroy grew up in the Southeast, constantly moving with his family as his father was transferred from one Marine base to another. Throughout Conroy's publishing career, he's been called a Southern writer. But for the time being, he's left the American South to live in Italy with his wife and children. Pat Conroy told me how difficult life with his father could be.
Dad mistook, for some reason, unbeknownst to me, he mistook his family for a platoon of Marines. I mean, the exact same thing he brought to the disciplining of a squadron, a battalion, a platoon, he brought to the disciplining of his children. He ran the house. He had Saturday morning inspections for us. He had white glove inspections for us as kids.
What would you have to do?
Well, he would, we'd have to stand by the door at attention, and Dad would come in and flip quarters on the beds. And, you know, he did that whole thing. And I think partially good humoredly and partially because he didn't know how else to relate to a family.
Did he bark out orders to you?
Oh, of course. I mean, Dad's friendliest tone was a scream.
Did you have to address him in a deferential way?
Well, in fact, Dad, I did not explain this in the book at all, but my father modestly referred to himself as the Great Santini when we were growing up. And he took it, I later learned, he had seen a high-wire aerialist when he was a boy. And he was up doing acrobatics in his airplane. When he came down one time when he was a young lieutenant, he said, "I was better than the Great Santini today." And some of the other pilots heard it, and the nickname stuck. So the Great Santini was how he liked being referred to by his children. He would line up his seven children, and there was this ritual we'd go through. And he would say, "Who's the greatest of them all?" And we, the seven, would say, "You are, O Great Santini." And he would say, "Who knows all, hears all, and sees all? You do, O Great Santini." So this was a ridiculous way I was raised.
What would happen if you violated his orders?
He disobeyed him. He would knock you around, and you would not do it again. It was dangerous to cross, Dad, at that time.
Did you actually have to sing the Marine hymn on family outings?
Oh, sure.
Like the family does in the novel?
I can sing it to you right now. I mean,
go ahead.
The Marine Corps hymn is like the family anthem. I mean, when I meet kids in the Marine Corps, that all of us have gone through this thing. It is when I find out that they also grew up in the Marine, they will say to each other, "Semper Fi." And we'll know, it's almost like a code word, a password between Marines and Marine kids all over the world.
What role did he have for your mother and for your sister, since, you know, if the model of the family was the Marines are a male group. So what were they supposed to be doing?
Well, I don't think my father noticed that he had daughters. I think, you know, part of the damage of the childhood was I simply don't think they were acknowledged as human beings at all. Or, you know, one of the reasons I became a cook later on in my life was I was not allowed to cook an egg. And the girls all learned how to cook. The girls all learned how to sew. And the roles were so clear and differentiated that there was no, you could not deviate from that at all. And I think it especially damaged my sisters because there was nothing they could do to get my father's attention, to win his approval. They could not play sports. They could not do these other things. They could not be tough. They could not be macho. And so I think they suffered just from sheer neglect, if nothing else.
What were you expected to do when you were young to prove your masculinity?
Dad signed me up for football, basketball, and baseball every season of my life and never asked me if I wanted to play it or not.
Did you want to play it?
You know, eventually I got to like it. But I remember at first, football scared me to death.
One of the climactic scenes in the book and in the movie is when the son and the father are playing basketball together, and the son is about to win for the first time. And just as he's shooting the winning basket, the father, I think, punches him in the stomach. Like he can't stand that his son is about to beat him for the first time.
All my brothers and sisters have stories about dad like this. I remember when my sister was about to beat him in checkers for the first time, he knocked a board over. I mean, dad was one of these people that simply could not lose. You know, he could not stand it. When a kid was beating him, he would go crazy. When the child came to that moment, which, you know, you have to come to. I mean, dad played old maids like he played football. He just simply had to win every single thing, every single time.
Do you think that that's had a crazy effect on you in your later years?
It's had a crazy effect on my entire family. Yeah. I mean, we've all had to, you know, live with this particular legacy of, you know, my brother and sister and I get together, and it's an articulate group and a very funny group, and we talk about it constantly. What damage? What happened? How is it affecting you now? Can you control your temper? How do you treat your wife? How do you treat your husband? How do you treat your family? How do you treat your kids? And we're constantly having dialogues about this, of what effect dad had and mom had on our own lives now.
In a lot of families, there really is a legacy of violence if one of the parents is prone to hitting someone in the family. That's sometimes a habit that's passed on to the kids, even if they don't share that kind of violent streak.
I was in an adolescent psychology class at Citadel when the guy said, if you had a mother who was beaten, there's a great chance you'll beat your wife. And if you were beaten as a child, there's a terrific chance you're going to be a child beater yourself. The line changed my life because I thought of some poor woman I hadn't even met walking around the United States or the world not knowing she's going to be beaten up by me. And these kids unborn, not knowing they were going to be born into the family of a child beater just because I was. So it really did have a great effect on me.
So what'd you do?
I told myself I was not going to beat my wife or children. And I haven't, which does not mean I've been a great husband or father, but I hadn't hit him.
Your father used to beat your mother?
Oh, yeah.
Did the kids try to stand up for her?
Oh, sure. We tried to stand up. It's very hard when your father's 220 pounds and you're 60 pounds. I noticed that we did not do much good.
Did she defend him for it?
What she would do, and which is the Prince of Tides, is a lot about my mother. What my mother would do, after Dad would hit one of the kids, or hit two of the kids, hit all the kids, hit her, she would usually get in the car, we'd drive out, she'd be saying, I'm going to divorce him, I'm never going back. We'd cheer. There'd be this incredible solidarity of these seven children, this one woman going out. Of course, because she was a woman in the 50s and 60s, where was she going to go? What was she going to do? How was she going to feed these seven children? Naturally, she had to go back. But what she would do, we'd go back and she'd say, that didn't happen. And she would invoke family loyalty and she would say, what you just saw happen did not happen. And so we grew up as this family of deniers. And people who knew us for years were stunned when The Great Santini came out. Because we had this appearance of being this happy, large, smiling family. We taught to smile, put the best face forward. And so when the book came out of Dad swatting us around the room, no one believed me.
So that kind of revisionism in the family would prevent you from even sharing confidences with good friends about what happened?
No, and I never told a friend that I was hit when I was growing up.
It's a big burden to keep to yourself.
I think so. You know, I didn't know it at the time because it was the only life I'd ever led. And I had no idea that it was any different than any other family. And now my sister knew it. My sister, when she was about six, said, Mom and Dad are crazy. And I have no idea how she came to this conclusion, but she was saying they were crazy from the time she was a little girl.
You had said that your family denied that any of this abuse happened in the family, but you put some of it in The Great Santini, in both the novel and in the movie, and it was there for the world to see. I mean, it was pretty evident that it was autobiographical. How did they deal with that? They couldn't deny it anymore.
Well, we had an odd thing happen in the family chronicle. As soon as this, I didn't tell anybody The Great Santini was being written. I was just writing this thing, and it was causing me, you know, because once you say this is true, and you start naming the beast that hurts you, so I started doing this, other truths come out. You know, how am I leading my own life? What am I denying? Since I brought such great powers of denial into my adult life, what am I not doing as a husband? What am I not doing as a father? And the whole thing started unraveling with me. That once I kept it up close to the chest, I could hold it all in. But once I started letting it out, it all started coming out. So when the book came out, my mother stunned us all by leaving my father. I think 3 months before the book came out, she left my father the day he retired from the Marine Corps. They had a parade and march, and she came home and left me.
Do you think that was because the evidence had been clearly
presented? I don't
think presented?
So. I think it was, I don't know what it was. I mean, she should have left him the second or third day of marriage tops. I mean, she should have been gone. If she had any survival instincts, any insight, she should have been gone. But she was 18, I think, when she married, so she's a kid. I think she just had gotten tired of it. And once he'd gotten out of the Marine Corps, once she had done that, most of the kids were raised, she just said she was not doing this anymore. And she took off. Then the book comes out chronicling this abuse. And my mother simply took the book and gave it to the presiding judge at the divorce trial and said, this is what happened. So this, it was my first introduction to the difference between life and art and how they sometimes interact with each other.
Did the judge accept that as evidence?
Well, he didn't accept it as evidence, but he read it.
How did your parents feel about being portrayed by stars?
They simply loved it. I mean, the book they had great problems with, but they went wild when a movie crew came to my hometown, or what we then claimed as our hometown, Beaufort, South Carolina, where the great Santini took place. And my mother got to teach Blythe Danner how to use the rosary, and my father got to walk around with Robert Duvall. And so they even though they were divorced at this time, they loved the fact that their lives were important enough to be portrayed by great actors and actresses. And it was odd seeing, there's a scene in The Great Santini, the movie, where I'm watching it with my father, I'm watching it being filmed, and there's somebody playing Dad, and there's somebody playing me running around. Blythe Danner playing my mother is sitting in the stands. Directly behind Blythe Danner is my real mother. They put in as an extra. And on the basketball court, playing with the guy playing with me, is one of my brothers playing on the basketball team. So we really mixed, we had a collage of all this when that movie was being made. But it certainly reconciled them to the book.
Did that make it easier for you to write more autobiographical work?
You know, the one thing is I never asked permission to write. You know, since it's my life too, I always figure if I lived it, and they were around, and it's, you know, you hate hurting people, you hate, you know, putting them in a situation, you hate writing about stuff that they don't like you to write about, but, you know, if I'm going to be honest as a writer, if I'm going to have any sort of credibility as a writer, I like pulling these things out of my life that have affected me, that have given me moments of great pain or great joy. I mean, this seems to be the material of every writer's life. And I love hearing writers say, no, this is completely made up, it's a composite. With my own life, I have to say, no, this is something, this is very close to me. This happened to me. These were people I knew. Because if I don't, I feel like I'm lying, like my mother used to do. I feel like I'm denying, like my mother used to do. And this is part of the reason I write, because I want to celebrate these people. I want to celebrate them with all their warts and flaws and glorious parts.
Why do you want to celebrate your father? You said your mother should have left him 4 days after they were married.
You know, because Dad was a jerk. I mean, but he's an honest jerk. As I look at the guy, the one thing that I came to the conclusion was that amazed me in that book is that Dad, though he beat us, though he screamed at us, though he was horrible to us, he loved us in this stupid, dim-witted way, this bovine way of his. He simply had, like many men in our country, he had no vocabulary for love. He had no emotional context for love. He had never been loved. His parents had treated him as coldly as you can treat anybody. Dad simply did not know how to do it, and he didn't know how to do it now.
Pat Conroy is my guest, and his novels include The Great Santini and The Prince of Tides, which is his new novel. Your novel, The Lords of Discipline, is based on going to cadet school.
Right.
Did you want to go?
No, but that's, once again, Dad did not ask me if I wanted to play football, nor did he ask me where I wanted to go to college. He simply said, you're going to the Citadel, son. It's Military College of South Carolina. So he sent me to the Citadel, and after plebe week, and I think a week later, they let us call home for the first time. So Mom answered, and I was crying. I said, you know, as soon as I heard her voice, I just simply broke down. I said, Mom, you have sent me to a torture chamber. What is this nonsense? I'm supposed to go to college, drink beer, I mean, meet people and have fun. So Mom cried, Dad got on the other end. I said, Mom, I'm coming home. Dad said, in that charming voice of his, "Where's home, son?" So I said, "Dad, I don't care what you say, I'm getting out of here." And Dad said in this line, he said, "Son, if you leave that school, you're a pansy." He left not much choice at that particular time. So I graduated.
What kind of discipline were you exposed to?
Well, they, you know, this is the, I think the plebe system at the Citadel was the toughest plebe system in the country at that particular time. I hear they've cleaned it up. There's a lot of hazing. There was, you know, a tremendous amount of screaming, even, you know, not letting the cadets eat at mess. And I'll tell you, it was an interesting milieu for a novelist. It was like being in Dante's Inferno for a year of my life. And they tear you down that first year, and then they build you up in the next 3 years, and they have this way of making you proud and making you love the place. And it always seemed schizophrenic to me that, you know, you could hate a place so violently and then feel such nostalgia for it at the end of it.
When you were in cadet school, were you already interested in writing?
Yeah, I was very interested in writing. My mother raised me to be a writer for some odd, strange reason. She was, you know, my father was from Chicago. My mother was from a very, very southern family. I mean, a very poor family. And my mother, for some reason, got into her head that southerners made the best writers. My mother loved to read. And from a very early age, she told me she wanted me to be a writer. Now, when she got interviewed a couple years before she died, and they said, "When did you know Pat was going to be a writer?" And my mother, with her great sense of style and drama, said, "I knew it when the nurse brought him to my bed the day he was born." So I said, "Mom, if that was true, why didn't you name me some great name like Rutledge Ravenel Conroy, or why Pat?" And my mother said, "You've never understood the elegance of simplicity." But she got it in her head that I was going to do this, and she never had any doubts. She never told me why, and it didn't surprise me when she got angry when I did it.
Well, I bet the cadet school you were in wasn't known for its writing program.
The writing program was not strong. I can honestly tell you that I think they're still astonished that they've produced. They seem kind of proud of it, even though they were furious with the Lords of Discipline. They seem sort of inordinately proud that I am a novelist, that the school did produce me. They even use me on brochures. You know, not only do we create great military leaders, we create artists, novelists. It rather tickles me.
It's funny that with all this Marine training that neither you nor any of your brothers became Marines.
Dad had 5 sons that did not spend one day in the military. I said, "Dad, does it tell you anything?" And he said, "Nope."
You not only didn't serve in the Marines, but you didn't want to serve in the Vietnam War.
No, Vietnam War. I was against the Vietnam War.
So you got a teaching deferment. Taught in a small school on a Georgia Sea Island?
Well, that came later. I taught first in Beaufort, South Carolina. I was a teacher and a coach in Beaufort, South Carolina for the first 2 years out of the Citadel. Then I accepted a job on Dufusky Island, South Carolina, the third year. And after that, I was fired, and I retired from teaching forever.
And that last experience was the basis of
The Water is Wide.
Water is Wide.
Exactly.
Which was made into the film Conrad.
Right.
Why were you fired?
Gross neglect of duty, insubordination, conduct unbecoming a professional educator, and AWOL. I might as well have gone into the military.
Boy, but you were really on your own and fighting back.
Yes, this was not a good time in my life. And I came up against, when I went to this island, it was the first year of teacher integration in South Carolina. So I was integration. I was the only, you know, white person in this school. So I went over there and taught at grades 5 through 8 and found out that the kids didn't know what country they lived in, didn't know what state they lived in. The thing they thought that Savannah, Georgia was the largest city in the world, which is okay. I can deal with that. They thought Bluffton, South Carolina was the second largest city. And I realized I had come across this island of innocence and neglect. These kids simply had not been taught. Attention had not been paid to these children. So the first day of school, I wrote the superintendent of school and said that your school's a garbage dump and we all ought to be ashamed of ourselves. And that was the beginning of the end with me and the superintendent. So it turned out to be a fascinating year, but it ended with my early retirement from teaching. And there was a trial, and I lost, and eventually I wrote The Water is Wide.
Did your failure as a teacher launch your career as a writer?
I guess it did. I don't think that, you know, I'd written a book first about this commandant at Citadel, who we called and he got fired. And I said, why'd you get fired? He was the only guy that was nice in the whole place. And I wrote his stories down. He had these great stories of this military college over the years. And I got started like this. I don't know if you're interested in writing, but I knew nothing about writing or getting published. You know, they said we didn't have a creative writing teacher. We had none of this writer-in-residence stuff. So I just had never met a writer at this particular time in my life. And I guess it was, the Boo was sitting on his bed on the Citadel campus, smoking a cigar, and he said, Bubba, you're an English major. Now, at the Citadel, this meant, this is almost an open admission you were gay at the Citadel. They had so few English majors, I can't even tell you. But he said, you're an English major, Bubba. How do we get a book published? I said, Colonel, I have no idea at all. And this is true. He smoked a cigar and he said, let's look in the Yellow Pages. So he got the Charleston Yellow Pages. He looked, Terry, in the Yellow Pages, under printing, there was a company that said, business cards, invitations, books. I went down, guy said, sure, we'll publish your book. $1,500. I went to Willie Shepherd at the Bank of Beaufort, who was a Citadel graduate. I said, Willie, I'm doing this book on the Citadel. Need some money? Willie gave me the $1,500, and that's how I got published. The first time.
And the second time? Because that was self-published. How'd you?
That was self-published. Well, I thought I was going to do it the second time, too. I was going to write this book on Dufusky Island. And as I was writing the book furiously, and I was enraged, I wanted to explain to this town why I was fired. I was simply writing in a white heat. I was so angry at the superintendent. I was so enraged at this entire situation. So I am writing every day. And a writer came through town who had heard about my getting fired. Newsweek did an article about my getting fired. And this guy came to me and said, you need a New York agent. So he gave me the name of Julian Bach, who I called, and I said, Mr. Bach, I'm from Pack on Earth from Beaufort, South Carolina. I think I have this wonderful idea. He said, get off the phone. What are you doing? And out of courtesy to this writer, he said he'd look at the manuscript. Now, I cannot tell you how small Beaufort is or how innocent I was in those days. I was so excited that I had a New York agent, not even knowing what that was. All my friends raced over, and my wife handed them out a chapter at a time and said, Pat's got a New York agent. They flew off with these, and each of them typed it overnight, where I had a manuscript the next day. I had forgotten to tell them. Some did it on onion skin paper, some did it on yellow paper, some did it on line paper, different kind of typewriters. Well, Julian, of course, gets this and thinks Little Abner is now in his stable. He thought it was the most adorable, cute, rural thing that had ever happened to him in his life. He just melted. So he accepts the manuscript, takes it to Houghton Mifflin, calls me up 3 weeks later and says, I've got great news. Houghton Mifflin has agreed to publish your book. And here's the great news. And he says, $7,500. And, of course, I said, in my innocence, in the line that he repeats, I'd say 100 times a week, Julian, I don't think Willie Shepherd down at Beaufort Bank is going to lend me $7,500. Julian, in stunned silence, then says, Pat, you realize they pay you, you don't pay them. And that was my first lesson in publishing, and that's when I think my career actually started.
Novelist Pat Conroy is my guest. His new novel is titled The Prince of Tides. He's also the writer of The Great Santini. I'm under the impression that the Prince of Tides is a much darker exploration of the kinds of emotional problems that parents can cause than The Great Santini is, which has a certain irony and detachment
and charm
about it. Yeah.
A certain charm, the dad's beating his wife. There was, I realized when I wrote The Great Santini, I had not told the story of my family, that I had denied and had lied as much as I had always blamed my mother for doing. So I wanted to get into the heart of darkness of our family. And I thought if I did, it's probably true of most families. You know, usually when I meet people and I talk to people, you know, a family can be a dark chronicle. And a family, you know, if you start scratching the surface, a family can be a very, very tough thing. You know, I was very surprised when I got married that I was no good at it. I just was not a good husband. Then I realized, of course you're not a good husband. Look who your model was. Of course you're not a good father. Look at the only father you've ever seen raise children. So to break those things, to break those bonds of the past, it's necessary for me to dive into the wreck to find out what it is. and to see if I can discover what the truth of that family is. And I still haven't done it. I mean, there's still things in the family that, I mean, my brothers and sisters have been helpful to me because they said, yes, there was damage. They have been honest about that. Yes, we came from a screwed up family. Yes, mom was screwed up. Dad was screwed up. Yes, it got to us all. And then I was, and why I love my family so much is when mom died, we just came apart. I mean, my family simply came apart at the seams. And where I thought I'd be a Gary Cooper-like figure, you know, yes, mom's gone. It surprised me. I just, I did backflips. I leapt on mom. I went under the bed, around, slithered around like a snake in the floor. I just simply went crazy at the actual time she died. And it was that coming apart and then that coming together as a family whenever a death comes in that affected me a great deal. And I realized I was glad that we were an emotional family and a passionate family. And that's one thing mom's death did, and it brought it all together. And after mom died, I could then go back and finish this book.
How do you think your children will describe your family?
You know, imagine, I said, you know, with my kids, the one thing with my kids, I do a little thing in the book about the way I've raised my kids, is I've joked with my kids. I say, kids, I'm screwing you up. I don't know how I'm doing it. I am screwing you up badly. You'll be in a psychiatrist's office because of me. Now, I wouldn't do it if I knew I was doing it, but I'm a parent. I can't help it. So I'm screwing you up, so it's your job to sort of listen to me, pretend you're doing what I'm saying, but lead a secret life where you're your own person, doing your own thing. And that's the best advice I can give you. And of course, now, since they're my children, they go, oh, Dad, please shut up. Be quiet, Dad. This again, Dad. So I have not changed this thing with kids at all, but I have simply tried to tell them that, you know, my way is not the only way, and they're going to have to do the best they can. I just can't be one of these parents that can pretend he knows what to do.
That was novelist Pat Conroy. His books include The Great Santini, The Lords of Discipline, and his latest, The Prince of Tides. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Jay Goldman and Joyce Lieberman. The interview was edited by Maeve McGoran, assistance from Marty Moss-Cohen. Amy Sallet is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I produce the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview, or for a listing of other programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4802. That number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible in part with funds provided by Philadelphia-based Cigna Corporation, a provider of insurance and related financial services to businesses and individuals worldwide. Additional funding comes from NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.